Americana.
Separated by 16 months of time, two small ships touched the shores of America and discharged their cargoes. The first, in August of 1619, landed 20 black indentured servants on the shores of Virginia. The second, in December of 1620, disembarked 104 determined religious dissenters on the coast of New England. 2.5 centuries later, in the summer of 1854, several companies of men and women climbed a barren hill overlooking a broad river 40 miles inland from the eastern border of the newly formed territory of Kansas. The companies of emigrants halted, looked down upon the narrow plain between hill and river, and resolved upon it as a town site. The settlement, which in the autumn of 1854 began to rise at the base of the Kansas Hill, had its genesis in the landing of the shipload of black servants at Jamestown and of the Mayflower on the coast of Massachusetts.
The words you have just heard were written by Alan Crafton in his recent book, Free State Fortress. This program is Americana, the eighth in a series of radio essays on the American scene presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Yankee Crusade.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. Perhaps you've had quite enough of Thanksgiving by now. The turkey is reduced to a skeleton with only the bonier parts left to be turned into croquettes or hash. Of the pumpkin pie, nothing remains but a few soggy crumbs, and the cranberry sauce is hardened into a substance rather like the jawbreakers the children used to buy at the corner grocery. In short, Thanksgiving is over, and I'm sure that you don't want to hear the stories of Captain Miles Standish and Samoset and Governor Bradford retold at this point. And in fact, the story that we have for you tonight is not simply a revision of these old histories. Our story is, I think, rather appropriate for a post-Thanksgiving evening. It might almost, in the manner of Robert Benchley, be called After Thanksgiving What? Anyhow, you'll forgive us, I hope, if we seem to go all the way around the barn in getting our story told. The story might begin with a side comment that James Street made in his rough-and-tumble history, The Civil War.
Next, President Lincoln called for 75,000 volunteers to put down the rebellion. Then the South moved. Virginia spoke out that she'd furnish no troops to the United States, and furthermore, no invading Yankees were going to cross her hills to get to her sisters. The North's eyes popped open and her jaw sagged. Virginia was something the North understood. The apple farmer in upstate New York didn't give a continental array about Mississippi way down yonder in the swamp and wilderness, and less than that about Texas. But Virginia was the Republic's foundation stone. And I wish that the television folks who sell soap, light bulbs, and deodorants, and who write our history in gooey songs and leggy dances, would learn that Jamestown, Virginia, was our first permanent English colony and not Plymouth, Massachusetts.
I'm not sure what Mr. Street had seen on his television set to disturb him so. Possibly it was an old movie with Paul Mooney playing the part of Robert E. Lee. This highly individual outlook is the particular delight of Mr. Street's book, however. The work might quite reasonably have been entitled Me in the Civil War. It's the kind of history, or fiction if you like, that will either infuriate you or amuse you, though you may not consider believing much of it. And Street's point is well taken. I looked into Richard Morris's Encyclopedia of American History to get the dates straight. Mr. Morris, as usual, did not fail me. Most of us who are not historians, I suspect, tend to imagine the Mayflower as she sails from England on the 16th of September, 1620, as starting a lonely and daring voyage from civilization into nothingness. Daring the voyage was, of course, and lonely in a way. But the truth is that the waters of the Atlantic had been crossed and recrossed for nearly 40 years before the Mayflower voyagers sighted Cape Cod. And, of course, by November 1620, a colony had existed at Jamestown for over 13 years. Indeed, Captain John Smith had had his celebrated adventure with Pocahontas in the Virginia colony before the Scrooby separatists left England for Holland on the first leg of their long voyage, which was to end at Plymouth. Perhaps we should look briefly at the story of the Jamestown colony. Last year, Bradford Smith published a biography called Captain John Smith, His Life and Legend. Through the story of the swashbuckling captain, Mr. Smith contrives to tell a good deal about Jamestown and the people who settled there. The venture in which Captain Smith took part was a somewhat different affair from that of the Pilgrims. Sir Walter Raleigh and other English gentlemen had spent much time and vast sums of money in trying to found a colony in Virginia. None of these men was especially motivated by religious or humanitarian ideals. Their notions were somewhat simpler. They wanted to get rich.
On December 20th, 1606, the little fleet weighed anchor and dropped down the Thames. The Sarah Constant was a vessel of 100 tons, not large, surely, even in those days, for the Mayflower was 180. But in comparison with the good speed of 40 tons and the pinnace Discovery of 20, she looked a proper ship. According to Smith, there were 105 men aboard the three ships, though the official reckoning apparently made before a final count was 60. With the Red Cross of England flying at her masthead, the Sarah Constant led the way downstream like a duck with her duckling, threading her way through the many ships anchored in the river. As the docks of the East India Company were at Blackwall, the odor of spices would have been wafted across the water, a promise to the voyagers of what awaited them in America. For most of them had in their heads visions of a fabulous golden land of bright skies and scented air, of obedient natives who would barter golden chains, yes, even golden chamber pots for trifles of cloth or iron. Even then, America was a dream, an El Dorado, a promise of something better.
The Sarah Constant and the smaller ships, after the usual run of bad luck, made it to the New World. On April the 28th, the voyagers went ashore at the place they named Point Comfort.
On April 29th, they set up a cross and called the place where they had set it Cape Henry. The next day, the ships were brought up to Point Comfort, where five Indians were seen on shore. Captain Newport immediately had the shallop manned. When he stepped ashore and laid his hand upon his heart, they laid down their bows and arrows and came boldly up, inviting him to their town. Their mats were brought out, the Indian chiefs sat down in a row, and the English were pressed to sit close by. While the English looked with interest at the birds, legs, feathers, deer fur, or plates of copper with which the Indians decorated their heads, the Native Americans gravely eyed the gorgeous silks and velvets with which the Europeans covered themselves. Food and tobacco were brought, and then the Indians danced, shouting, howling, and stamping against the ground, as one of the Englishmen wrote, with so many antic tricks and faces, making noises like so many wolves or devils.
Captain Smith was in the ship's brig at the time under suspicion of mutiny. Presumably he was out, at least on parole, when the colonists finally landed at Jamestown on the 13th of May. I don't wish to rehearse the early troubles of the Jamestown colony, which were many and varied. Since they were also the troubles of Captain John Smith, you can read about them in Mr. Bradford Smith's most interesting book. As Mr. Smith points out, it became clear rather early that the only basis on which the Jamestown colony could survive was farming, specifically the raising of tobacco. Captain Smith, who continued to be a highly controversial figure in colonial affairs, seems to have believed this, and to have argued that every man in the colony should be a free man and a landowner. He was probably right. At least if his advice had been followed, American history might have taken a very different and happier course. Certainly Smith's honesty and integrity are beyond question. No one who reads his words on the American settlements, which he wrote in 1622, can doubt that.
I may call these settlements my children, for they have been my wife, my hawks, my hounds, my cards, my dice, and in total my best content, as indifferent to my heart as my left hand to my right.
Now, as for those later venturers, the Plymouth Saints, we must dismiss them rather quickly, I fear. But in doing so, let me remind you of several really fine recent books in which you may read the full story of the Pilgrims, their associates, their enemies, and their descendants. About this time last year, I believe, we recommended to you George F. Willison's Saints and Strangers, A History of the Plymouth Adventure, as well as Mr. Willison's The Pilgrim Reader, a collection of first-hand accounts of those great days. I'll just add this year that Mr. Willison's books are still available, and if you haven't read them, you should. And then there are two really superb studies by Perry Miller, The New England Mind in the 17th Century, and The New England Mind from Colony to Province. I can't think of another treatment of any aspect of American intellectual history so scholarly, so fascinating, so well written as Miller's discussion of The New England Mind. But meanwhile, we've left the Mayflower Company tossing at sea and pretty uncomfortable. Perhaps we'd better let them land.
After they had enjoyed fair winds and weather for a season, they were encountered many times with crosswinds and met with many fierce storms with which the ship was shrewdly shaken and her upper works made very leaky. And one of the main beams of the midship was bowed and cracked, which put them in some fear that the ship could not be able to perform the voyage. Yet they commended themselves to the will of God and resolved to proceed. After long beating at sea, they fell with that land which is called Cape Cod, the which being made and certainly known to be it, they were not a little joyful. The wind shrinking upon them somewhat, they resolved to bear for the Cape, and thought themselves happy to get out of those dangers before night overtook them, as by God's providence they did. And the next day, they got into the Cape Harbor, where they rid in safety. Having thus arrived in a good harbor and brought safe to land, they fell upon their knees and blessed the God of heaven who had brought them over the vast and furious ocean and had delivered them from all the perils and miseries thereof, again to set their feet upon the firm and stable earth, their proper element. What could now sustain them but the Spirit of God and His grace? May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, our fathers were Englishmen, which came over the great ocean and were ready to perish in the wilderness. But they called unto the Lord, and He heard their voice and looked on their adversity. Let them therefore praise the Lord, because He is good and His mercies endure forever.
So we come down to an incident which an old friend of mine has described most appropriately, I think, as the last Yankee crusade. And indeed, the incident is very like the voyage of the Mayflower done all over again, this time on the prairies of the Middle West. But let's allow our author to make his own points. The writer is Alan Crafton of the University of Kansas. The book is his newly published Free State Fortress.
Separated by 16 months of time, two small ships touched the shores of America and discharged their cargoes. The first, in August of 1619, landed 20 black indentured servants on the shores of Virginia. The second, in December of 1620, disembarked 104 determined religious dissenters on the coast of New England. 2.5 centuries later, in the summer of 1854, several companies of men and women climbed a barren hill overlooking a broad river 40 miles inland from the eastern border of the newly formed territory of Kansas. The companies of immigrants halted, looked down upon the narrow plain between hill and river, and resolved upon it as a town site. From indentured servants, the blacks and the ships which followed the Virginia ship were first reduced to limited servitude, then to slavery, which was given statutory recognition by the colonies. The English colonists who followed the first shipload of religious dissenters became town builders, merchants, and seamen. The settlement, which in the autumn of 1854
began to rise at the base of the Kansas Hill, had its genesis in the landing of the shipload of black servants at Jamestown and of the Mayflower in the coast of Massachusetts. The year 1854. The 20 black men from the Virginia ship, which had been followed by hundreds of other ships, had multiplied into many thousands of slaves. Most of the North had emancipated their slaves by 1840, but south of the line named for Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon, who had surveyed the boundary between Pennsylvania and Maryland, a society had grown up. A society of wealth, culture, and pleasant living. And an empire of national political dominance had been built, whose economic life was rooted in the unpaid labor of black slaves. The year 1854, the dissenting Plymouth Rock Pilgrims had grown not into a society of pleasant living and political dominance, but into half a dozen states nurturing stubborn and set beliefs. The years had been hard in the progeny of the Mayflower passengers. Though their sailing ships had brought fortunes to their seafaring men, the majority had amassed small wealth from the thin, rocky soil. Material-minded, envious, they still carried over from the earlier days when they had crusaded for religious and political independence, a confidence in man's future, and a faith in his capacity for greater freedom. James Otis and John Adams were dead, but the New England Garrisons and Thayers, they were still crusading for the freedom of all men, including the black man of the South. As the year 1854 opened on the rolling prairies stretching to east and west of the barren hilltop beyond the Missouri, tribes of Delaware, Shawnees, Wyandots, and Kaws had their homes. The hilltop and its surrounding mainland, it was all known as Missouri Territory. It was a quiet, peaceful land occupied by shiftless, contented, credulous people. As the year 1854 closed, a town was rising at the base of the hill, a town settled by men and women newly arrived from New England. The men who, among other motives, had come to make the new territory a free state were on the alert and carried guns. Beyond the town limits and stretching eastward to the Missouri line were armed riders, incoming Northerners and pro-slavery men from the border counties of the slave state of Missouri. Resentful of the Yankee invasion, strong in their conviction that the territory should be slave land, the Missourians were determined upon the withdrawal of the Yankees or their extermination, while the red men withdrew closer to their primitive villages and watched the maneuvers of the white forces as they made ready for conflict.
Mr. Crafton's Free State Fortress was written and published, I assume, chiefly because the state of Kansas is celebrating her 100th anniversary this year. Not the 100th anniversary of her discovery by European explorers, for Francisco Vasquez de Coronado wandered across the Arkansas River in June of 1541, still looking for the gold of Cibola. Nor the centennial of her admission as a state, for that came in 1861. But in 1854, the first permanent settlements were made in Kansas. One of the first, and certainly the most important of these, was Lawrence, which is where Mr. Crafton happens to live. Perhaps you'll bear with me if I add a very short comment or two about this book and its author, and then we'll go on to the Yankee Crusade. Alan Crafton has been, as I say, a friend of mine for many years. He was one of my teachers when I attended the University of Kansas. He is, in fact, one of the half dozen really distinguished teachers under whom I've been fortunate enough to study. The United States must be rather generously sprinkled with ex-students of his who have every reason to agree with me. I should be very much surprised if there were not a few of them listening to me now. One of the reasons for Professor Crafton's distinction as a teacher is that he's a profoundly creative man with an extraordinary talent for original work in the various arts. He has, for example, written well and voluminously for many years, especially about Kansas history. I hope you'll forgive me if I say that he should have published much more of what he has written. I'm sure that it's only accident that he's published Free State Fortress, but for me it was a fortunate accident. I hope there will be more of them, and I hope that you'll order a copy of the book and read it, for it will introduce you to one of the most dramatic and least known episodes in American history. The story begins in 1854, as Stephen A. Douglas, described as an apostate Vermonter, introduces a bill into Congress.
The plain lands west of the Missouri River shall be hereby erected into a temporary government by the name of the Territory of Kansas. And when admitted as a state or states, the said territory or any portion of the same shall be admitted into the Union with or without slavery as their constitution may prescribe at the time of their admission. That, gentlemen, is the substance of the bill before the Senate.
The bill was a sad blow to the abolitionists, for it seemed inevitable that the new states bordering as they did on slave territory would themselves become strongholds of slavery. It was probably the sheer impossibility of competing with the pro-slavery groups for the new territory which aroused the Yankee stubbornness of men like Eli Thayer and later Amos Lawrence. For what Thayer proposed was to organize and subsidize the migration of free staters to the new territory. Hundreds and thousands of abolitionist settlers who should build new towns, who should electioneer and campaign and vote the new states in for freedom. Thayer traveled up and down New England more than 60,000 miles in all, urging his scheme upon his fellow Yankees. And, of course, the scheme worked. Lawrence was the first free state town to rise west of the Mississippi, and there were others that came later. And although such cities as Leavenworth and Atchison were settled originally by pro-slavery partisans, the free settlers held their own. But then, as Crafton tells the story, a strange thing happened. The first election for a territorial legislature was to be held in the spring of 1855.
During the quiet afternoon of March 29th, the masons and carpenters along Massachusetts Street, the men digging basements for their new homes, commented from time to time on the day's elections. They believed that they could carry the election for a free state. At any rate, the legislator from their own district would be for a free state. Lawrence didn't have more than a dozen or so pro-slavery voters within its city limits. Suddenly, the men stopped their work. Riders and wagons could be seen nearing the town along the trail south of the river. They circled the settlement and halted, set up a camp where Baldwin had camped the autumn before. The visitors made no effort to muffle their conversation. They talked loudly and boastfully as they unharnessed their teams and pitched their tents for the night. Several men resolved to cross the ravine and see what was going on. The crowd on Massachusetts Street increased as they waited for the men's return. The report of the returning scouts was not encouraging. There must be nearly 1,000 present or on their way. They're Missourians, all right. They're friendly enough. One of the men, Colonel Young, made a speech. He called for volunteers to set out for some other voting district, since he said they had more than enough in camp to carry the Lawrence district.
Of course, the outcome was just what you might expect. There were 1,034 votes cast in Lawrence the next day, but only 232 by bona fide residents of Lawrence. The whole Kansas legislature was overwhelmingly pro-slavery. But these hardy pilgrims were not as easily discouraged as you might imagine. Nor were they, and this is especially hard to conceive in 1954, nor were they overly terrified at being on the wrong side of the law, if the law collided with the dictates of conscience. Well, let me tell you what the free staters of Kansas did when they found themselves under a pro-slavery legislature. It was the simplest thing in the world. They repudiated the legislature and started to set up a state government of their own. You'll recall that according to the history books, the Civil War began in 1861 with the firing on Fort Sumter. What happened in Kansas from 1855 on was one of those unrecognized wars in which the suffering is just as real and the dead just as dead as at Shiloh or Brandywine or Tarawa. There were raids back and forth. The Free Staters called the Missouri Raiders border ruffians, and the Missourians began to know the Kansas Raiders as redlegs or sometimes jayhawkers. Lawrence was once raided and partially burned by a howling mob under the nominal command of a federal marshal. And John Brown, whose marching in those days was not so much admired by either side, in one night murdered all the pro-slavery men along Pottawatomie Creek. But above all else, and perhaps worst of all, there was the cold and the dry spells and the terrible plagues of illness which struck down the settlers on both sides. In a way, the coming of statehood in 1861 was almost anticlimactic. The status of Kansas had been settled by that time, but they celebrated anyway.
Now there was excitement galore. The members of the legislature, which was still in session, were aroused along with other citizens, and an impromptu celebration was held on Massachusetts Street. There was righteous criticism of the raucous hilarity of this jollification, which included the generous sampling of illegal whiskey. So on the next night, a second celebration to which the ladies were invited was held. This one included patriotic speeches, prayers of thanksgiving, and the firing of a salute of 100 guns. Lawrence now enjoyed 9 weeks of peace. Then on April 12th, another rider galloped up the road from Leavenworth. He too bore news which he revealed breathlessly. Fort Sumter has been fired on. The Union is at war. War? The armed rebellion of the South has begun? The people could not believe, did not dare believe. They repeated the phrases numbly. Fort Sumter has been fired on. The Union is at war.
I can't help pointing out to you that the people who survived all this strain, terror, and death were tough. Not necessarily brawny, not cold-blooded, certainly not bulletproof, but tough mentally and morally. Like them or not, agree with them or not, you can't help admiring people like the preacher Richard Cordley and his congregation. Mr. Cordley missed holding services the first Sunday after Quantrill's raid on Lawrence. That was 2 days after the raid, and the fires were hardly extinguished, nor the dead buried. But on the Sunday after that, August 30th, he preached a sermon to his people.
Having stood for 9 years as the outpost of freedom, shall Lawrence be deserted now? Shall we leave these broken walls to the owls and bats? Leave the new-made graves of these martyrs to be torn up by the wild beasts of the field? Shall history say that freedom here sought a home and was driven out by the minions of slavery? No, my friends. Lawrence may seem dead, but she'll rise again in a more glorious resurrection. Her ranks may have been thinned by death, but let us close up and hold the ground. The light of liberty which shall shine from her rising walls will yet penetrate the mists of our neighboring state, and we shall see eye to eye. The conflict may not be ended, but the victory must be ours. We may perish, but the principles for which we contend will live. For freedom's battle once begun, bequeathed by bleeding sire to son, though baffled oft, is ever won.
You have been listening to Americana, the eighth in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Noble. Musical supervision by Maurice Streetmatter, and engineering by Ed Gullett. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grisky. This is NBC Radio.